Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Center for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXIII, Zenobia. The weakness of Rome was the strength of Palmyra, and the East came to be ruled by the Queen Zenobia. Cultured and ambitious, her empire stretched from Egypt to Turkey, which made a formidable challenge for Aurelian. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
So a lot's been happening in the East since we were last over there. So you might remember that Septimius Odenathus, who is the leader of Palmyra, he's a Palmyrene as well as a Roman citizen, senator and consul, was essentially controlling the East in Gallienus's name, with Gallienus's say-so, because Gallienus had problems with the rise of the Gallic Empire.
But the reality was, this was a man who seemed to be subtly, even if not intentionally, setting himself up with his own territory.
Yes, I mean, he claimed the Persian title King of Kings, would certainly indicate that no one else on earth is better than you, including the Roman Emperor. He was murdered, however, probably in about 268 CE, and it's probably due to a court conspiracy. We talked about the various other stories that the Romans were involved, but it really does seem to have been an inside job.
Yeah.
And this meant that there was a bit of a power vacuum, and into that vacuum steps his wife, Septimia Zenobia. Now, she's a very young woman. She must have only been in her late 20s. Of Palmyrene noble birth. They had at least one child, at least one son, Vabalathus. If they had other children, it seems that they would have. They would have had some daughters. Zenobia is not with Odenathus when he is murdered. She must have gathered her own supporters in Palmyra. A later Byzantine source, Sincellus, refers to some of Odenathus's closest allies supporting her and her son, Vabalathus, who's only 10.
So she's doing this in her son's name, by the sounds of it?
Definitely. So she has Vabalathus proclaimed with Odenathus's titles, both corrector, so that's the man in charge of the East, and King of Kings.
He adopts the Roman titles like they are something to inherit. They aren't.
No, they have to be bestowed by the emperor. Mm. Of course, there are problems themselves happening in the Roman Empire at the time, because Gallienus is murdered and there's Claudius Gothicus. And Claudius seems to have been largely content to leave them alone during this period. He has problems with the Goths himself. There is a suggestion, and some scholars argue, that he was planning a campaign against Zenobia when he died. And, you know, it's probable that that would have been on his agenda, but we don't have any evidence for this. Gallienus and Claudius Gothicus, they certainly don't acknowledge Vabalathus and Zenobia, and for their part, the mint of Antioch in Syria continues to mint coins of Claudius once he becomes emperor. So, you know, there is this tension here between both sides, where Zenobia and Vabalathus are claiming titles and wanting them essentially to be acknowledged by Rome.
Okay, so there's still a kind of an uneasy middle road of trying to define this as splitting from the Roman Empire at this point.
Exactly. So to local audience, we know from a milestone, which is found near Palmyra, inscribed in both Greek and Palmyrene, describes Zenobia as most illustrious queen, so Basilissa in Greek, and the mother of the King of Kings, and Vabalathus as the most illustrious King of Kings and corrector of the entire East. So they're appealing to their local audiences by saying, you know, Odenathus may have died and his 10-year-old son is in charge, but there is continuity. His mother is here as well. But at the same time, they're minting coins for the Roman emperors, you know, really wanting recognition the same way that Odenathus was recognized.
Okay. This feels like it's a step too far for any Roman emperor to accept if there weren't bigger problems to deal with.
Exactly. So there is a story. This is accepted by Nathaniel Andrade, who is the most recent biographer of Zenobia. It's an excellent book. I don't quite agree with him on this point. He dates an expedition by Gallienus's general Heraclianus, which only attested in the Historia Augusta, to this period. And his argument depends on there's an inscription in North Africa which gives Claudius the title of Parthicus Maximus.
Okay.
But very often inscriptions in the 3rd century include victory titles which the locals think they should have. So if he's an emperor, he should have the title Parthicus Maximus. So it's not conclusive proof. And this is because Nathaniel Andrade wants to argue that the Romans took the offensive first against Zenobia, and so Zenobia's following actions, in which she invades Arabia and Egypt, were actually in response to Roman aggression.
Mm.
I think the evidence is very circumspect. I think that Zenobia was probably seeking recognition from the Romans, and when it didn't come, then took further aggressive steps to try and force their hand.
That seems to be a lot of confusion, but at some point there's going to be a clear division between the East is no longer part of the Roman Empire. And that does happen, doesn't it?
Yes. So Zenobia, and this is probably in 270, she mints coins proclaiming her son, Vabalathus, as Imperator Caesar.
Okay.
Sometimes he's shown with Aurelian, but other times he's just shown alone. And then in 270, Zenobia's army, led by her general Zabdas, invades the Roman province of Arabia. They take the capital of Bostra. They defeat the Roman governor, Trasus. And we know, for example, that the Palmyrenes destroy the temple of Zeus Ammon in Bostra because there is an inscription referring to its rebuilding in later years, saying that it was destroyed by the Palmyrene enemies.
Mm.
Zenobia's forces then move on to Egypt. This is, of course, a key strategic location. Egypt is a major source of grain for Italy. The Roman prefect of Egypt, Terneginia Probus, is currently away on a mission clearing the seas from pirates. So Zabdas, with his army of 70,000, that nice number 7 again, manages to capture Alexandria. Probus returns and manages to oust Zabdas' forces. But there's another battle, and this time the Palmyrenes are again victorious. Another Palmyrene general called Timagenes fights against Probus, and Probus kills himself, opening up the way for the Palmyrene domination of Egypt. We have an interesting insight into the impact of this Egyptian campaign. There's a funerary inscription of a soldier found in Arabia which says, "Odious Egypt snatched away the souls of many, including that of yours." It's a nice insight into this conflict, the way it was remembered by soldiers who died in it. Now, papyri from Egypt shows that documents were dated now according to the joint rule of Vabalathus and Aurelian, which suggests that the Eastern regime is still portraying this as a joint rulership and they still want recognition from Aurelian. Now, Nathaniel Andrade points out there is nothing to suggest that Zenobia cut off the Egyptian grain supply to Rome. This may be because she was still hoping for recognition for herself and her son. And we're not quite sure how this is done, but we know that Zenobia's influence and the control of Palmyra encompasses all of Syria, including Antioch, as well as parts of Asia Minor. So Zosimus, Book 1, Chapter 50, says the Palmyrenes occupied the east as far as Ankara in Galatia. This, of course, is where the Res Gestae was inscribed on the Temple of Roman Augustus. So this is central Turkey. And they would have acquired Bithynia even as far as Chalcedon if the inhabitants of that country had not learned that Aurelian had been made emperor, and so they shook off the Palmyrene yoke.
At this point, it doesn't seem realistic that they would be able to get endorsement from Aurelian to, definitely not as co-rulers. That seems to be a very lofty aim.
Yeah, so it is one of the things we see in the third century is that you do find generals who've been claimed emperor or local elites that proclaimed emperor wanting recognition from the central administration. But really, they've gone so far now to, you know, carve out their own empire that, you know, it's really unlikely that Aurelian is going to be happy with this. You know, we've seen some of his character, you know, his actions towards the Senate, you know, his relentlessness towards the Euthyphrungi. This is a man who's not going to take this lying down.
Well, this isn't just, you know, the carving out of territory and people proclaiming for a different ruler. This is them actively going and conquering territory. There was a battle in Egypt. People died for Rome.
Mm.
And, you know, they now potentially have the capacity to cut off the grain supply, which is something that was attributed to encouraging the riots in Rome that we heard about the last episode, isn't it?
Yes, that could be a possibility there, that if they received news of the capture of Egypt, then that would be another reason why they would riot. So, you know, both Zenobia in the east, and then you've got the Ufungi in Italy as well. So yeah. Aurelian has problems on all fronts there.
So was Zenobia conducting herself as a queen at this point? Do we have any records about what sort of ruler she was trying to be?
Yes. So certainly, you know, she gives herself the name of queen, or Basilissa, so in Greek. You know, she stars herself as the mother of the king of kings. And she does assemble court around her, influential writers and thinkers. So we have Cassius Longinus, a philosopher from Emesa, who taught at Athens. Both Historia Augusta and Zosimus refer to him as an influential advisor to Zenobia. Then Callinicus of Petra, a Rhetor, a sophist, wrote a history of Alexandria in 10 books, which he dedicated to Cleopatra. And so we think Cleopatra is Zenobia herself, who might be styling herself as the continuator of the Ptolemaic dynasties there.
I gather we don't have those 10 books.
Alas, no.
Of course not.
A lot of these things are only known from titles and stray references there.
Yeah.
We do sort of see her sort of controlling the local area. So there are stories in the Talmud, the Jewish text, that show her arbitrating over judicial cases. And there's even stories about Paul of Samosata, Bishop of Antioch, having a close relationship with Zenobia, converting her to Judaism. Now, there's little to support this observation, but certainly there's the idea that in the eastern provinces, she is the one that's ruling, not Aurelian.
Okay. So I gather at this point that Aurelian can make a distinction between, while the people who are currently ruling the West are conducting themselves as Romans, this is a foreign enemy now.
Yes, they're claiming Roman titles, but they are foreigners who are illegally taking Roman titles. It's not been confirmed. Odenathus was given titles by Gallienus, you know, and as you said, they're not inheritable.
Yeah.
So Aurelian moves to the east, and in the winter of 271-272, the Northern Hemisphere, of course, he's based in Byzantium. And in early 272, Vellabathus takes full imperial titles. He's known as Imperator Caesar Augustus, Pius, so Pius, Felix, Fortunate, and Invictus, Unconquered. And Zenobia takes the title of Augusta and is styled as Mother of the Emperor.
Are they actually taking Roman titles?
Yes.
Wow,
yes.
Okay. That's not just a translation kind of...
No, they are actually taking... They are in Latin on coins as well. So this is interesting because we saw this with the Gallic Empire as well. They sort of see there's sort of no alternative to Rome. Rome has ruled these territories for so long that what is going to replace them? So we saw in the Gallic Empire, they take, you know, all the titles, they have consuls, they have senate, you know. In the East, you know, if you want to rule effectively, you want to show that there's continuity here. So yes, you rebel, but you take Roman titles to show, you know, the continuance of that idea.
So Aurelian moves east. You said he was in Byzantium.
Yes, so he's in Byzantium. He moves in the spring of 272. He recaptures Ancyra in Galatia, and then moves eastwards to Tyana in Cappadocia. And there's a very famous story about Aurelian, which features in the Historia Augusta, but also in our contemporary source, the anonymous continuator of Cassius Dio.
Oh, corroboration.
Yeah, so that's nice to see for once. And this is fragment 10.4, which I will quote. Aurelian, in the siege of Tyana, said to the troops, "If we get inside, do not spare a dog." But after the capture, he ordered the troops neither to slaughter nor pillage.
That's contradictory.
Yes. The troops, being angry, said to him, "Allow us to do those things which you commanded." And he said to them, "It is true that I said, depart, let not a dog be found in this city, but slaughter all." And he sent forth both the tribunes and the troops to slaughter all the dogs, in consequence of which the anger of the army was dispelled in laughter.
Oh, he literally killed just the dogs.
Yes.
Hilarious.
Yes, yes. Well, apparently this is what the army thought as well. And then he assembled them and said, "We waged war to free these cities. If we pillage them, they will never trust us. But instead, let us seek the spoil of the barbarians and spare these as our own." So he's saying, these are our own people. We're liberating them, so we can't kill them, but we can kill their animals.
Okay. Yeah, no. This comes up, you know, I think in the very next episode, whether you should let the army loot a city that
yes.
Because you need to keep the army happy.
Yes.
They want some spoils of water carry off.
Of course.
And, you know, they need to let their anger out on local canines, apparently.
Yeah.
I feel like saying, you know, Historia Augusta has got to be the Historia Augusta, but this is in two different sources.
Yes, no, it's a contemporary story told. Even if it didn't happen, it was clearly a story that circulated in the period. Yes, that it tells us something about Aurelian's personality.
And they're just the sense of humour of the army.
Yes, yes, exactly, yes.
Okay, so Aurelia then moves further into Syria. So he would see himself as liberating these areas, I guess, retaking what is Rome's.
Definitely.
Yeah. Are they coming across a lot of resistance?
Yes. So he is moving into Syria, and then he actually sends another force to retake Egypt. Egypt is retaken by June of 272, so that is quite easy. But in Syria, of course, this is where Zenobia and her main forces are. So in May or June of 272, Aurelian and Zenobia's forces clash at Imai near Antioch. Now, Zosimus, relying on Dexippus, tells us about the battle. And this is Book 1, Chapter 50. There, finding Zenobia with a large army ready to engage, he met and engaged her as honour obliged him. But observing that the Palmyrene cavalry placed great confidence in their armour, which was very strong and secure, and that they themselves were much better horsemen than his soldiers, he planted his infantry by themselves on the other side of the Orontes, that's the river.
Mm.
He charged his cavalry not to engage immediately with the vigorous cavalry of the Palmyrenes, but to wait for their attack, and then, pretending to fly, to continue so doing until they had wearied both the men and their horses through excess of heat and the weight of their armour, so they could pursue them no longer. This project succeeded, and as soon as the cavalry of the emperor saw their enemy tired, their horses were scarcely able to stand under them or themselves to move, they dropped the reins of their horses and, wheeling around, charged them and trod them underfoot as they fell from their horses, by which means the slaughter was promiscuous, some falling by the sword and others by their own and their enemies' horses.
Yeah, okay. That's using the climate against them, really.
Exactly. Zenobia escapes from the battle. And then a ruse is thought of by Zabdus, Zenobia's general, in order to help her escape. So Zosimus tells us that he chose a man resembling Aurelian and clothed him in imperial dress and led him through the city as if he had taken Aurelian prisoner. And then, since the people of Antioch were fooled, he fled the city by night, and Zabdus took with him Zenobia and the remainder of the army to Emesa. In the meantime, Aurelian enters Antioch, where he is joyfully received by the citizens.
How does the ruse help Zabdus?
Because he and Zenobia are able to escape undercover.
Okay.
Because he confuses the people of Antioch into thinking that they're victorious.
Yeah. Okay. All right, that seems really complicated and involved. You just put a shawl on.
Yes.
You open a side door and you exit stage left.
Well, I guess he wanted them to think that the Palmyrenes were still in control, so that I suppose if the people of Antioch knew that they had been defeated, they might be looking for, you know, Palmyrenes to kill, including Zenobia.
Yeah, okay, because earlier in this episode, Antioch had been taken by Zabdus and his army.
That's right.
So yes. These are people who are living under duress, I guess.
Yeah.
And these are good loyal Romans that Aurelian would see.
Exactly.
Okay, all right. That's a bit more of an interesting ploy to get out. Zenobia and Zabdus escape, and Aurelian is welcomed in as a liberator.
Exactly. So that gives him the opportunity now, having secured Antioch, the largest city in the east, to move again to track down Zenobia. So he goes to Emesa, homeland of the Severan dynasty, or part of them anyway, and then he defeats Zenobia's forces again, even results in the capture of Zenobia's treasury. Her advisors tell her to retreat now to Palmyra, leaving Emesa to Aurelian. Now, the anonymous continuator of Cassius Dio tells us the story in fragment 10.5 that, and I quote, Aurelian sent ambassadors to Zenobia, urging that she concede to pay tribute under him. And she declared in turn, I was not greatly harmed, for those who fell in the war are nearly all Romans. So, you know, a bit of a loss of reality there, if that's what she really said.
Maybe she's insinuating, hey, my troops are Romans too.
Oh, that's a good point. I didn't think of that. Yes, yes, we're Romans too.
You know,
yes,
it's no great loss. I'm not losing my own man. I'm losing yours.
Oh, yes, I hadn't thought of that. No, that's a good point. Yes, yes.
Okay, next article.
Yeah. No, good. So she's going, then she moves back to Palmyra. But, you know, the city has no walls. It only has some ramparts. So it's not the most defensible city.
Ramparts only must make it an easier job to besiege. But I get the impression that Aurelian also wants to take Zenobia alive, which is an extra kind of problematic undertaking.
Yes, he does. So Zenobia tries to avoid this. So Zosimus says she tries to escape to Persia. So she goes off on a camel, but is captured while trying to cross the Euphrates. So with her capture, Palmyra surrenders and Aurelian takes the name of Parthicus or Persicus Maximus. And even in some inscriptions, as an unofficial title, we find Pauraniacus Maximus, so the greatest conqueror of Palmyra. Coins are minted now at this point, proclaiming him as Pacata Orbis, so pacifier of the world, and Restituta Orbis, restorer of the world. The idea that he's now reunified at least part of the Roman Empire, even if...
So it seems a bit premature, yes.
Yes, well, you know, it's that is, you know, propaganda is often, you know, partly hope as well as the reality. Zenobia and Valabathus are sent for trial at Emesa. Aurelian actually doesn't execute them because he wants to lead them in his triumph at Rome. So instead, her advisor, Cassius Longinus, is executed. And it may also be the general Zaptus is killed as well because we don't know what happens to him. Aurelian now sets course back for Antioch, taking Zenobia with him. There are stories about her being taken in chains, sat on a donkey and, you know, humiliated publicly in cities along the routes. We know that Aurelian and the army make it back to Byzantium for the winter of 272-273. During this time, he also campaigns against the Carpi in Thrace, but it's there that he hears that there's a rebellion in Palmyra under a leader named Antiochus. So in early 273, he goes all the way back to Palmyra and then, according to Zosimus, razes the city to the ground.
Right.
Now, we know this doesn't actually happen because of the archaeological evidence. There's certainly destruction, but it's not a complete removal. There's also supposed to be a revolt in Egypt by a certain Claudius Firmus, who the historian Augustus says is an ally and friend of Zenobia. But clearly it was so important to him to personally put down this insurgency, to send the message that, you know, rebellion in this area is over, that he actually travelled back from Byzantium all the way to Palmyra, where his destination is Rome.
Yeah, well, after laying siege and after capturing Zenobia, as the emperor, you would think that everybody in this area has learnt their lesson. For there to so quickly have been a rebellion or an insurrection of some sorts indicates that you've left behind people that you probably shouldn't have and that all of this could just kick off again.
Yes, that's right. And he does want to make sure with his personal message that this does not happen. Then Aurelian and company again go overland back to Rome again.
So Aurelian has captured Zenobia for a reason, and that is to march her in the triumph, to make an example of her and to show that this is a great victory. And I want to discuss Cleopatra illusions a bit more. But to Romans, there is something a bit problematic about acknowledging a foreign queen, I think.
Yes, that's right. And also, you know, the fact she was ruling together with her son, but of course he was only a 10-year-old, so he wasn't the one making decisions. So in the Roman psyche, there is definitely memories of Cleopatra here. And we find this in the Historia Augusta, which really plays up the connections between Zenobia and that sort of style of female Hellenistic queenship.
So she's captured in 272, 273?
She's captured in 272, and she spends the rest of the time, as does her son, with Aurelian's retinue.
Yeah.
Now, Zosimus says that she dies in captivity en route to Rome, but he's the only source that says this, and there is evidence disproving this. She and her son are certainly exhibited in triumph.
2 years later in 274.
Well, this is the thing. Yeah. So, depending on who you read, the triumph over Zenobia happened in 273, or they waited until 274 and had a double triumph over Zenobia and the Gallic Empire.
Yeah.
But either way, they're exhibited in triumph, but she gets pardoned and is allowed to retire. It's even said that, you know, she retires to Tibur, so modern Tivoli, and she lives near Hadrian's villa. Presumably her son,
Vabalathus,
yes, survives. We don't know what happened to him. Now, we do have good evidence of descendants in Rome, either perhaps through her daughters, or she may have remarried again. She was still very young. We don't know. But there is an inscription from Rome, which is erected by a nurse called Aurelia Publiana Elpidia. And it's erected by the nurse in honour of her charge, a Clarissima Puella, so a girl of senatorial family. And the girl's name is Lucia Septimia Patabinia Balbilla Tyria Nepotilla Odinathiana.
Now, I recognise the last name there.
Yes. This woman can only be a descendant of this family of Zenobia. And so the fact that she is also a Clarissima Puella indicates that the family, at least in subsequent generations, had senatorial rank. This is a 4th century inscription. You can now find it built into the exterior wall of a bar in Trastevere in Rome. It's one of my favourite places to show people when I go to Trastevere. Once when I went, there was graffiti on it, which made me very sad. Oh. Sometimes it's blocked by a car. But, you know, it's great to be able to visit there and say, you know, that this is a descendant of Zenobia. And this is their family continuing in Rome, which is, you know, really quite remarkable.
Is there any significance to the other names that this girl had?
Well, certainly Septimia would indicate, again, it's from the same family because they were given citizenship in the Severan period. Tyria refers to Tyre. Nepotilla would mean little granddaughter. There's certainly probably some intermarriage with members of the senatorial aristocracy here as well.
Okay, so pretty good indication that she survived, possibly her son survived as well to have these children, or that she's had more children.
Exactly.
Who knows, because she's not the focus of the story, according to the sources.
Yes. We don't know at all, but it's clear that they survived and flourished, which is, you know, really quite remarkable, given, you know, everything that happened in the war against Aurelian.
Can we now spend a bit evaluating this person? Because it's not often that we get so much information about an enemy of Rome, let alone a woman. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but, you know, not since Boudica and Cleopatra. She takes on an almost mythical persona. And I see a lot of Cleopatra in Zenobia, and it sounds like not only did the Romans play on that, but she played on that as well.
Yes. So the evidence for her playing on it is this 10-book history of Alexandria, which was dedicated to Cleopatra, which could only be her.
Yeah.
But certainly the way in which the Historia Augusta represents her is that she is able to assume such power because an emperor like Gallienus is so weak. So it's all about the weakness, or this crisis of Roman masculinity.
So it's not because of something that she achieved or anything like that. She was just in the right place at the right time.
Yes, exactly. So Historia Augusta in the Lives of the 30 Tyrants wrote in chapter 30, "Now all shame is exhausted, for in the weakened state of the Commonwealth, things came to such a pass that while Gallienus conducted himself in the most evil fashion, even women ruled most excellently."
Compared to Gallienus.
Exactly. So he talks about Zenobia being like the Cleopatras, says that she even took on the robes of Dido, the queen of Carthage, you know, back from the stories of Dido and Aeneas. Also, there's this story about a confrontation between Aurelian and Zenobia because, you know, we always have to have a scene and the enemies talk to each other.
Mm.
So again, Historia Augusta says, "When Aurelian had taken her prisoner, he had her led into his presence and addressed her thus, 'Why is it, Zenobia, that you dared to show insolence to the emperors of Rome?' To this she replied, 'It is said, you, I know, are an emperor indeed, for you win victories. But Gallienus and Aureolus and others I never regarded as emperors. Believing Victoria to be a woman like me, I desired to become a partner in the royal power, should the supply of lands permit.'" Now, Victoria is the mother of Victorinus, the Gallic emperor, who arranged for Tetricus to take the throne
when her own
son had been killed. Okay. So she's comparing herself with Victoria in the East. Now, in reality, they probably never even heard of each other. But, you know, it's supposed to be a sign that Roman male leadership is so weak that these women are able to rise up and challenge Roman power.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's also complimenting Aurelian in the same sentence. It's criticising those that have come before, but, you know, if Roman emperors were more like you, Aurelian, then this never would have been an issue. And the Romans have to say themselves, yeah, okay, valid point, Zenobia.
Yes. That's right, exactly. Because, you know, Aurelian is remembered as this great general who reunified the empire, so, you know, she has to give him some credit because she did defeat him.
But at the same time, in the same breath, this is the Historia Augusta.
That's right. No, this is all fictitious. But it does give us an insight what Romans in subsequent generations thought about Zenobia. And, you know, she does, you know, take on this mystique as, you know, the woman who stood up to the might of Rome. There's a wonderful painting of Zenobia looking over the ruins of Palmyra, her last look at Palmyra, painted by Herbert Schmaltz in the 19th century, which is now in the Art Gallery of South Australia in Adelaide. Well worth a visit. It's a really fantastic painting. And then also in South Australia, we know that female suffragettes who were campaigning for women's votes would write anonymous letters and pamphlets using Zenobia as a nom de plume to argue for women's rights to vote. So it may have been that they were influenced by this painting. There's this symbol of a woman who was standing up to men.
What about as a historical figure then? Because these kind of people who can be romanticised can also be mythologised.
Mm, mm. Alaric Watson in his book on Aurelian, you know, has this quote from Edward Gibbon that Zenobia is perhaps the only female whose superior genius broke through the servile indolence imposed on her sex by the climate and manners of Asia, which is really quite terrible. It comes through, it's this, you know, Eastern Orientalist idea of, you know, decadence, which, you know, we've now moved past, thankfully. The idea that, you know, it's only rare that a woman is able to stand up to men, and that's why we should remember her. I think we should look at her story quite differently. You know, she was a woman in her 20s when her husband was murdered, essentially, in a palace coup, 10-year-old son, probably some daughters. You must think of, you know, the courage and the conviction, the sheer determination to actually take that and rule successfully for several years and to stand up to the might of Rome. Mm. You know, that's really an amazing achievement. She must have been an incredible person.
That was Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe on any readily available podcatching platform. Leave a review there, they're always very appreciated, and hey, tell a friend about the podcast. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on what is left of Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode of Emperors of Rome, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.